Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, welcome to the Sydney Institute tonight for Anne Blaney's talk on Nellie Melba. I'll introduce Anne Blaney first. She's well known as an author. She's the author most recently of I Am Melba, which was published a couple of years ago, reprinted in 2009 and reprinted again last year. And I'll introduce Anne Blaney briefly. She's written five biographies. The first two, The Founding Poet and Immortal Boy, were about 19th century English writers, and they were praised by reviewers in Britain. On This Life of Melba reflects her fascination with singing and opera. Anne Blaney has served on the council of two Australian opera companies and on the council of the Percy Grainger Museum in Melbourne at Melbourne University. Her previous book was Fanny and Adelaide, The Lives of the Remarkable Kimball Sisters. But tonight on Nellie Melba, and we've called tonight's talk Dame Nellie Melba, A Woman of Contrast. Now, following that, Renee Martin, an opera singer who's just come back from Europe to have an offspring, will be singing. And she'll be accompanied, I'm pleased to say, by her husband, not by anyone else's husband, Gavin Lockley, who is Renee's husband and accompanist, and a composer, a piano player, and a singer in his own right. So we'll start with Anne Blaney. We'll go straight across to our musical performance. Then we'll have questions and discussion. There you go. So, Anne Blaney, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to see everyone here, and thank you, Gerard, for a most generous and kind introduction. I must say something more about Gavin Lockley. He and I are writing an opera on Kingsford Smith. I am writing a biography currently on Kingsford Smith, and all today we've been wrapping up a couple of arias, haven't we? Yes, absolutely. I've done the words, of course, and Gavin has done the music. Well, I expect most of you know something about Nellie Melba. You wouldn't be here probably if you didn't. I imagine that most of you know that she was the most celebrated opera singer. What I expect some of you don't know is just how famous she was. Melba was the celebrity of her day. Everyone across England, Europe and America and Australia knew her name. Her activities were constantly being reported in the papers, and when she appeared in public, she was mobbed by fans. The Americans invented words for the mobbing. They called it the Melba Rage and Melba Mania. Melba's tremendous fame came basically from the beauty of her singing voice and the extraordinary skill with which she used it. But her fame was also greatly helped by her early emergence as a recording artist. The gramophone had scarcely been invented when Melba decided to record her voice. By doing so, she managed to reach millions of people, a feat that had been impossible for any previous prima donna. We must also remember that apart from a few queens and princesses, few women had worldwide fame during Melba's time. No woman was Prime Minister or Chief Justice or head of a big financial house, and there were very few female film stars at that time. Pop stars and supermodels just didn't exist. And in a sense, one could say that Melba was first of the famous female pop stars. Well, Helen Porter Mitchell, which was Melba's real name, was born on the 19th of May, 1861, near the corner of Burnley and Victoria Streets in the Melbourne suburb of Richmond. Her parents, David Mitchell and Isabella Mitchell, had migrated from Scotland to Melbourne, and soon after arrival, David Mitchell bought several acres of land in Burnley Street, where he set up a business as a building contractor and brickmaker. By the time Melba was born, he'd built a large house next to his mason's yard and brickworks, and it was here on the banks of the River Yarra that she spent the first 21 years of her life. Melba was the eldest in the family, and she was musical from the start. Family legend has it that she could never be kept away from the piano. and by the age of 8, thanks to the tuition of her Aunt Lizzie, she was an accomplished pianist and a promising young singer. We know this for certain because that year she took part in 2 amateur concerts in the Richmond Town Hall, that of course is the Richmond suburb that she lived in, both of which were reported in the local paper. The reviewer was astonished that so young a child could be so mature and brilliant a performer. The second one that she took place in, she was the only child on the program. Everyone else was a good amateur or a semi-professional singer, which just shows how terrific she was at that age. Melba's musical instruction continued under professional teachers when at the age of 14 she entered the newly opened Presbyterian Ladies' College. Overall, academically, she was no more than an average student. However, she was well above average in elocution and English and art, and outstanding at piano and organ and singing. At this stage, however, the piano was her chief study, and when she told people that she believed that she could be famous, everyone imagined she was aiming to be a famous pianist. It was pretty unusual in those days for a woman, or a young girl rather, to think that she was going to be famous, and I think Melba set herself apart at the age of 15 when she made that statement. In 1879, when she was 18, she left school. That same year, her mother became ill, and at the end of 1881, her mother died. As Melba stood beside the deathbed, Isabella Mitchell put the 7 younger children into Melba's care and spoke especially of 4-year-old Vera, the youngest child. Melba, who loved her mother dearly, saw her mother's words as a sacred charge and had Vera's cot moved into her own bedroom. She was therefore sleeping beside the child when on the 19th of January 1882, little Vera became ill. As Melba lay on her bed, racked with anxiety about her little sister, she believed she saw the figure of her dead mother glide out of the shadows and point to the child. Next day, Melba, in some alarm, described the vision to her father and begged him to call a doctor. He brushed her words aside and said he would see how little Vera was when he returned home that evening. His decision was tragically ill-advised. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Vera was dead. Melba described herself as being shocked, bewildered and depressed by this double dose of death. I think this is probably an understatement. I think she had a nervous breakdown. As well as grieving for her mother and little sister, she must have been carrying a burden of guilt because her mother had left Vera especially in her child, at her care, and that burden of guilt must have been crushing. We do know that David Mitchell was worried about her, so much so that he decided she should have a change of scene. He owned shares in a sugar plantation in Mackay in North Queensland, and he suddenly decided to visit it, taking Melba with him. Melba was a huge success in the small town of Mackay. The town and district contained a cultivated group of English pastoralists and planters, and Melba was soon a star performer at the concerts that provided their cultural life. She also attended the performances of a travelling opera troupe that was holding a season in Mackay. These may have been the first operas that she ever saw, and the excitement generated by those simple performances left a lasting impression on her. Melba, who was a strikingly attractive girl, soon found herself courted by Mackay's young bachelors, and gradually one of the young men began to stand out from the rest. He was Charles Nesbitt Armstrong, the penniless younger son of an Irish baronet. He was tall, handsome, a daredevil rider, and the type of young man who acts first and thinks afterwards. His nickname was Kangaroo Charlie, and that was a reference to his boxing prowess. He was very sexy and very attractive. For a girl who was still reeling from the death of the 2 best-loved people in her life and who was desperate for a love to replace them, Charlie's advent must have seemed heaven-sent. Within months, she was insisting on marrying him. Charlie and Melba were married in Brisbane, returning quickly to Melbourne for their honeymoon. Soon afterwards, Charlie accepted David Mitchell's offer of a manager's job on the Mackay plantation and sailed up north, leaving Melba, now pregnant, to join him 2 months later. During those 2 months, Melba took daily singing lessons from a talented Italian teacher named Pietro Cecchi, who undoubtedly laid the foundation of her extraordinarily fine singing technique. It was already clear that the girl who had decided at 16 that she would be musically famous, I thought it was 15 or 16, had taken note of the travelling opera troupe and was stealthily preparing herself for a possible future life as an opera singer. In due course, Melba returned to Mackay. Her son was born, the wet season set in, and everything went from bad to worse. Both she and Charlie had explosive tempers and their quarrels proliferated. One suspects that Melba's postnatal anxiety was high. After all, it was only 18 months since infant Veer's death, and here she was with another infant in her charge and no sympathetic family to support her. Shut up in a tiny house, which you can still visit, with the rain drumming on the roof, she'd reached the end of her tether. She wrote a letter to Pietro Cecchi saying that she and her husband were needing money and that they had decided she should return to Melbourne and prepare to join a travelling opera troupe. This was a lie. Charlie decided no such thing. He wouldn't have got him near a travelling opera troupe. But it's possible that at that moment of writing, she persuaded herself to believe it. A month later, she and the baby sailed for the security of Melbourne and her father's house. Back beside the Yarra River, she commenced singing and began to sing professionally in the hope of raising money for a trip to Europe. Her father, who considered a professional female opera singer only a few degrees better than a fallen woman, was a very unrespectable thing to do. You painted your face, you appeared in public, you took impersonated the moral people on stage. I mean, it was pretty low. My father refused to assist her, but a year later, he was persuaded to change his mind. In 1885, he was appointed Victorian delegate to the Indian and Colonial Exhibition in London, and Melba seized her chance. She argued so long and so hard to accompany him that at the end he gave in with one proviso. Her husband and child and sisters should go with them. Charlie was summoned from Mackay, and the Mitchell party arrived in London in May of 1886. Melba brought letters of recommendation to well-known English musicians and impresarios, but the results were disappointing. Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan fame auditioned her. All he offered her was an apprenticeship in the Savoy Opera Chorus, and the impresario Carl Rosa didn't even bother to keep the appointment. Her father and husband were delighted by her lack of success, but Melba still had one last shot to fire. She persuaded her father to finance a trip to Paris for her to audition for Matilda Marchesi, one of the most successful teachers of singing in Europe. If that failed, she said she would go back to Australia. At her audition in Paris, Melba sang A Forse Lui from La Traviata, with the formidable Madame Marchesi herself accompanying at the piano. Halfway through the aria, Madame stopped abruptly and ran out of the room. Melba was almost in tears. She was sure that she had failed. A moment later, Madame reappeared, tugging her harassed husband behind her. "At last I found a star," she called out. And turning to Melba, she said, "I shall make of you something extraordinary." Madame Marchesi's teaching was thorough. As well as teaching vocal technique and opera repertoire, she insisted that her pupils learn deportment, etiquette, fashion, languages, and movement. It was really a sort of finishing school for prima donnas, where they were totally turned out. Yeah. They could keep their head up in the best circles in Europe if they'd been through Madame Marchesi's school. They knew exactly how to behave. They learned how to eat in fine company, all the right sort of knives and forks and things, and they knew how to enter a room gracefully and all those sort of things. And she rechristened her pupils with exotic surnames, often inspired by the state or city in which they'd been born. For example, an aspiring soprano from the American West became Emma Nevada, and a young Canadian soprano became Florence Toronto. No prizes for who guesses that one. And Nellie Armstrong, of course, became Nellie Melbourne. Three times a year, Madame held concerts, which were glorified auditions. Concerts where her best students sang to composers like Gounod and Delibes, and impresarios like the manager of the Paris Opera. The newly named Melba absorbed the teaching and was soon a star performer at those concerts. After 18 months, she gained a contract to make her debut at the Monet Theatre in Brussels. Melba appeared as Gilda in Rigoletto at the Monet on the 30th of October, 1887. I've read the reviews she received in the Brussels and Paris papers, because it was such a big event, the Paris papers all sent reporters. The reviews are rapturous. The expertness of her technique astonished them. And here we must have a thought for Pietro Cecchi in faraway Melbourne. He'd given her the greater part of that technique, and it's a tragedy that he never received due praise. As far as Europe was concerned, Melba was the product of Madame Marchese's teaching. From now on, triumph followed triumph. The next year she conquered the Paris Opera, and her two sisters who were visiting from Melbourne could not believe their eyes when Melba came back and back for curtain calls. In 1889 she conquered Covent Garden, which from then on remained her artistic home. She sang at Covent Garden for part of almost every season for the following 37 years, and she made her final farewell from opera at Covent Garden in 1926. Though many of her triumphs were gained in England and France, her career was by no means confined to those countries. From 1893 onward, she sailed nearly every year to New York and sang in numerous seasons at the Metropolitan Opera, extending her work in 1906 and 1908 to Oscar Hammerstein's Manhattan Opera, where she earned the colossal fee of $3,000 for each performance, a really colossal fee for those days. In 1894, she formed her own American touring company, which proved so successful that for the next 30 years, she continued to tour with it almost annually, putting on concerts and opera tours across Canada and the United States, and travelling in a private train, especially designed for her by Mr. Pullman. Very luxurious train, needless to say. And of course, Melba made concert and opera tours of Australia. In 1902 and 1907, she returned on what could only be called royal visits. It was during the 1909 concert tour that she bought an old farmhouse at Lilydale on the outskirts of Melbourne, and I believe someone here lives at Lilydale, which is very nice, and she named it Coombe Cottage. In 1911, Melba returned to Australia for over a year, living at Coombe Cottage when she was not touring with her opera company and reconnecting with the land of her birth. On the eve of the First World War, Melba hurried to Australia to see her ailing father. And once war was declared, she threw herself into patriotic fundraising. At town halls around Australia, she held concerts, preceded by auctions of flags, discovering in the process that she was a born auctioneer. In past years, she'd been rather aloof with audiences, presenting herself on stage as a remote fairy tale figure in grand gowns and fabulous jewellery. At the patriotic auctions and concerts, she was still a grand figure, but she was a lot less distant. She beguiled and cajoled and cheeked the audience into parting with money. And this led to a permanent change in her public style. In future concerts, she would chat away to the spectators. Audiences loved her. She would kiss children in the front row. She would do all those sort of publicity things that people didn't do very much in these days. She was very much ahead of her time in all of this. It was one of the reasons, all this sort of behaviour, that she was given the title in Australia of Our Melba. Her fundraising was extended to America and Canada and is said to have raised £100,000 for war charities. It was for such work that she was created Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. Melba suffered many illnesses in these last years. Each winter she battled lung infections, to which were added colitis and gynecological problems, and finally diabetes. At first she managed to hide her ill health and kept up a frenetic pace of performances and travel. People marvelled at her seeming youthfulness, but eventually the struggle became too difficult to sustain. In 1924, Melba made another tour of Australia, bringing the largest opera cast so far to visit Australia's shores. On the final night of that season, she stood on the stage at Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne and she announced her retirement. It was a slow farewell, and you will all have heard the stories in Australia about the slow farewell. It was a slow farewell. She found it hard to live without the excitement of performing, and her farewells to opera and then to concerts went on for another 4 years. The sequence of farewells was not as unusual as people say, and there was ample historical precedent for it. Adelina Patti, the great star soprano of the previous generation, took 10 years. And Julia Grisi, the great star of the generation before Adelina Patti's, took even longer. And audiences really expected it, I think. It was just something that divas did. And don't you do it, Renai, though. Although much of her life was sensationally successful, Melba encountered problems along the way, both professional and personal. She'd been taught in Australia to sing by the bel canto method, which produced a light, flexible voice, well suited to florid music, and favoured by composers like Rossini and Donizetti, and Verdi in his earlier years. When she reached Europe, she found that style was going out of fashion, and heavier, more dramatic singing had gained popularity. Well, she was safe for the moment, since she sang the old-style repertoire so superbly. Nevertheless, a soprano couldn't hope to stay in the front rank unless she sang the heavy and dramatic operas of the rising favourite, Richard Wagner. In 1897, though it suited neither her voice nor her temperament, she attempted the role of Brunhilde at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. She only ever sang one performance. It was close to a disaster. Such a defeat would have disrupted many careers, but Melba kept her head, and she sensibly searched for a solution. She needed a dramatic modern style opera that suited a bel canto trained voice, and she found it in Puccini's La Bohème. She popularised the opera and she sang it with great success until the end of her career. La Bohème was a most important opera to Melba. She would have, I think, been pretty finished if she hadn't found it. It was very lucky. She was staying at a hotel in New York waiting for a ship to go back to England, and an obscure Italian company came to New York and performed in an obscure theatre. And she saw in the paper they were performing, and she decided she would go along and see what it was like. And she went to La Bohème, and she knew immediately that she'd found her opera. And when she got back to England, she got in touch with Puccini, and she travelled to Lucca to meet him, and she studied La Bohème. And it totally saved her career. And I think Renée's singing, aren't you? One of the great arias from La Bohème. Melba was fond of saying that the over-emotional prima donna was dead today and the best singers exhibited the qualities that have made them, this is in a quote, the qualities that have made them equally, would have made them equally successful as managers of big business or generals of great campaigns. She saw herself as a general of a great campaign, I think. And in this, she was very much a 21st century woman. And I think a lot of people didn't understand that at the time about Melba. They thought she was tough and hard, and prima donnas shouldn't be tough and hard. They should be emotional and sort of pliant. And I think, in a way, that was not a good thing for Melba's public persona. But nevertheless, it saw her through a difficult career. Well, what about Melba's private life? Well, there were problems there too, and it wasn't without its sadness. The stranger than exacting public career don't make for domestic happiness, which was a pity, because Melba was a family person, capable of giving and receiving love. She loved her royal lover, the Duke of Orleans, whom she met in London in 1890. He was a dashing figure, younger than herself, directly in line to the French throne if the Orleans royals were restored, and there was a fair chance at that time that they might be. He loved his Nellie for her unfettered Australian spirit, which made her so unlike the other women he'd known. The Duke and the Diva enjoyed a rather public affair for 2 years, at the end of which Charlie sued for divorce, naming the Duke as correspondent. As might have been imagined, this caused the Orleanists and Melba much embarrassment. It's usually said that diplomatic pressure caused the case to be dropped, but the legal records reveal that it failed because Charlie, who had spent most of the previous 5 years in Queensland, was deemed to be an Australian resident and was therefore not eligible to bring a divorce suit in the British Isles. Yes, that was the reason. I mean, Charlie stayed back in Australia enjoying himself, and Melba felt she was free to form whatever sort of liaison she wanted, and then he suddenly appeared storming along. He said he was going to sue the Duke for £1 million for the alienation of his wife's affections. Of course, he got nowhere. Unfortunately, the dropping of the divorce did not save Melba's and the Duke's relationship. They parted with grief on both sides. I think it was the genuine love of her life on both sides. There are letters that they wrote each other when they were old. They didn't see each other for a very long time, and they came together after the First World War, after a very long interval, and they wrote each other letters which have survived, and they're very sad letters, but they make it clear that they both thought about the other person right through those intervening years. The marriage to Charlie finished officially in 1900, when, while living in Texas, he sued for divorce on grounds of desertion. Melba didn't contest the suit, but she would have liked to have contested the court's ruling that their son George must continue to live with his father. Melba had never forgiven Charlie for having summarily taken the boy from his English boarding school and having spirited him away to America, where she was unable to trace him, his whereabouts. She got detectives, she did everything she could to find this child, but Charlie kept moving, partly to keep away from Melba, partly because he was restless, I think. And they didn't really know where he was until the divorce papers came and Melba gone on to Pinkerton's detective agency and they managed to find him. In fact, Melba was denied sight of George for 11 years, a source of the greatest pain to her. Mother and son were only reunited when George turned 21 and was legally able to leave his father. George returned to England to live with Melba. He wrote her a pathetic letter when he turned 21. She was staying again at the Manhattan Hotel in New York and he was up on the Canadian border. And he said, "Mother, I have thought of you every day that we've been apart and I'm coming to live with you now." It was such a sad letter. George returned to England to live with Melba and he brought her great happiness, threaded with some sadness. His first marriage to a fashionable English girl failed miserably, but his second to a warm-hearted Australian singer named Evelyn Doyle brought both Melba and George great joy. When his daughter Pamela was born, Melba's joy knew few limits. That daughter that was born, Melba's granddaughter, was Lady Vestey and she only died last October, so it shows how the family sort of survived on. In October 1930, Melba sailed back to Australia for what was to be the last time. She'd not been well when she boarded the ship and she became increasingly ill as the voyage progressed. When she arrived in Melbourne, she was met by an ambulance and she was taken to Mount St. Evans Hospital, where she recovered sufficiently to be able to spend Christmas at Coombe Cottage with her family. But her health still caused anxiety, and when her daughter-in-law's brother, who was a doctor in Sydney, came down to Coombe Cottage, Melba asked his advice. He decided Melba should go to Sydney to be under his care. So in January of 1931, she made the journey to Sydney and immediately entered St. Vincent's Hospital. And there, for nearly 2 months, she lay, at first recovering and then dying. What was the nature of her illness? Well, I don't know for sure. That she had septicemia is fairly certain. It's on her death certificate. But how she came by it is open to conjecture. The official version given out by the family is that she had typhoid, and the typhoid caused a rash on her face, and that turned septic. However, rumours persist that she was suffering from a botched facelift, performed in Europe prior to boarding the ship. But if this were true, then she would have had an infected face for almost 5 months, which seems an unlikely length of time. There were intervals during this 5 months, actually, when this infection, whatever it was and whatever caused it, actually cleared up. But then it would break out again. We know this because when she was in Sydney, the Sydney Morning Herald had a bulletin almost every day about Melba's health as though she was a member of the royal family. And we know that about 4 or 5 days before she actually died, she was doing quite well and was actually making plans for what she would do when she came out of hospital. Melba died on the 23rd of February 1931. Her death caused worldwide sadness. Newspapers worldwide carried obituaries and reminiscences. Few crowned heads of Europe could have provoked such public grief. Melba, through a large part of her life, had come close to being one of the most famous women in the Western world. As befitted such fame, the funeral was stupendous. The service was in Scots Church, Melbourne, which her father had built back in the 1870s. From Scots Church, the funeral procession snaked up Collins Street. First came the hearse, followed by 4 open vans carrying wreaths. Then a long queue of mourning cars and mounted police escort. The cortege stopped outside what is now the Victorian Artists Society in Albert Street. Then it was the conservatorium where Melba taught her Australian students the elements of bel canto singing. The students came out and placed flowers on the hearse, and many of them were sobbing. A few yards further down the street, the procession stopped again. This time outside Presbyterian Ladies' College, the whole school was lined up on the footpath to show respect for this most celebrated old girl. Then the long line wound down into Victoria Street, which was crowded with mourners, and it paused at the Yarra Bridge near the site of her childhood home, and all Richmond seemed to have come out to do honour to the little girl woman who had once been the little girl, Nellie Mitchell. And so her body processed down what is now the Maroondah Highway toward Lilydale. People sat in their cars or stood beside the road and waited for it to pass. There were few stretches of road untenanted. At Lilydale, the coffin was hoisted onto a gun carriage to be pulled to the cemetery by soldiers and by a pack of Melba's own Boy Scouts. Not long before her death, Melba wrote the following words. "I know," she wrote, "that the best of me will live and the worst will die. There may be fires to pass, tempests to face, but there's something that fire cannot burn and storm cannot quench. Call it soul, ego, astral body, call it what you will. I call it the true eternal me." Thank you.
No, I think we'll have our musical interlude and we'll come back for questions. Our singer Renee Martin and our accompanist Gavin Lockley are both announcing their retirement at the Sydney Institute tonight, but in view of their age, this will take half a century to come into fruition. So up we come.
Thank you.
So you want to hear?
Oh, yeah.
So you want this off?
Yes, please.
Okay.
But I also want to say something about goodbye.
Oh.
Yes, just for a second. That's all right, I can get it. Yes, Renee is singing one of the great arias from Puccini's La Bohème, an aria that Melba made very much her own. She was much identified with it. And she's also going to sing a song called Goodbye by Paolo Tosti. Now, Melba knew Tosti well. Tosti was an Italian, of course, but he was very anglicised. I think he was even knighted by the royal family, and he taught Queen Victoria's children music at one stage, so he was very much part of the establishment. He wrote a number of songs for Melba, and Goodbye was the favourite one of audiences. Year after year, people were always writing to Melba and saying, "Please, Madame, will you sing Tosti's Goodbye?" Melba got heartily sick of the song in the end. In fact, that's how the thing about Singer Muck came up, but I'll tell you about that perhaps later in the questions.
Singer Muck.
Yes, it was her sort of private word. Muck was her private word for hackneyed songs, and Tosti's Goodbye was fast becoming one in Melba's thoughts. But after the First World War, when so many people had sons and boyfriends and husbands and whatnot killed in the war, Tosti's Goodbye became even more important to them, and Melba hardly gave a concert without singing it.
Okay. Now we'll just turn this off and lower this down, and I'll strike back.
Play the piano on the way down.
Now I'm just going to disappear.
Okay.
La storia mia è breve. crinorare suona la sua vicina che la vien guaritora in pordonare.
Gavin, and we'll go back to questions and discussion, and we might get an encore if we're lucky. If we all behave, we might get an encore. Right, so I think we're right to come to questions and discussion. As Anne Blaney is coming up, I should say that Janet Grundy's got some copies of I Am Melba, and I'm sure Anne would be happy to sign them. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll go for about 15 minutes, I think. Just starting off, you've told us about, we've had a wonderful performance tonight, so many thanks to our artist. We've had a wonderful speech. About Melba, the artist. So I propose to lower the tone and ask about Melba's politics. I mean, what was she like? We were talking a bit earlier, but what was she like? What were her political views? I mean, did she have them? Yes. If she had them, what were they? Just a brief account of that, and then we'll raise the tone again.
Well, Melba had very decided views on a great many things, politics included. She was definitely a conservative. During the war, she threw herself into the war effort. Britain had to win. She got terribly angry in America, and when she heard people saying it mightn't win, she almost physically hit them, I believe, on some occasions. And she thought she went all across America and Canada during the war to raise money, once America came into the war, and across Canada, of course, all through the war, giving concerts and raising money. Some were spectacular. She gave one in San Francisco, and she asked them to throw coins onto the stage, and so many coins came that the orchestra were getting brained with these coins, and they wished they'd brought their umbrellas, they said. And one man said, "We've not seen anything like this, ma'am, since the gold rush." During the war here, when the referendums on conscription came up in was it 1916 and 17?
16 and 17.
Yes. Melba threw herself into the, yes, there must be conscription side. She spoke about it very forcibly, and indeed Billy Hughes, the Prime Minister, made a special visit to Coombe Cottage to thank her. After the war, she went back to England. She'd thrown herself earlier in England into the suffragette cause. She spoke out very forcibly in favour of the vote and said, of course, in Australia we lead the world, we've all got it. That was how she saw it. And she was very friendly with people who were close to the Pankhursts and were involved in really quite violent demonstrations. After the war, she went back and she was very worried about what she thought was a very cynical attitude and her upper-class friends. And her upper-class friends were very upper-class. She had been in the Prince of Wales' set, I might say, when Edward VII was Prince of Wales, and was a close family friend, really, of King George V and Queen Mary. And she taught Princess Mary the Princess Royal singing. So she was very in there. But she felt that a lot of her friends there were very cynical about the unemployment and the unrest that was there post-war. She felt so much about it that she teamed up with a young Conservative candidate called Lord Apsley, who was standing for the seat of Southampton. It was a pretty rough area, and Melba used to go to election meetings with him. And when things got too bad and the interjections were too violent, verbal interjections, I take it, Melba would jump up on stage and say, "I'll give you a song." And all the miners in, or whoever were in South, they weren't miners in Southampton, whether they'd be dock workers and so on, would shout out, "Good on you, Nelly, give us a song." And Nelly would oblige. And Lord Apsley said it was no end of a help. And he won the seat and he went on to be a private secretary for transport, I think it was, in the Parliament. She was such a success at this that she told reporters she was thinking herself of standing for the House of Commons. It never ever happened, but I think she'd have done well. She'd have certainly, I mean, I think she might have given Nancy Astor a run for her money. This, of course, is after women are allowed to stand for the House of Commons. This isn't, we're talking about 1922, 23.
Just stay there. Okay. There's a question here, and then down, right down the back. Can be quick, brief, yeah.
This recital, apart from the quality, reminds me of my childhood in Melbourne.
Here we go,
where
be quick.
We frequently, the family got together and people played the piano. Several members of the family had learned to sing with Italian, teachers. And this was just exactly the sort of thing you did on a Sunday or Saturday night in our family. But I want to say my mother nursed...
No, go on, be quick.
Nursed
okay.
Nellie Melba's son.
Is that right, George? Yes.
And when she went home, she saw this beautiful vase in her suitcase.
Yes.
And she was very embarrassed because she thought they would think I stole it. So she got in touch with them, and Melba noticed that she'd admired the vase.
And she'd given it.
And put it in
her. That's a lovely story. Typical. Melba did a lot of quietly generous gestures.
So this was which child?
This is only her only son, George. He had terrible illnesses. He had two very bad illnesses in Australia where he wasn't thought that he would survive.
And how long did he live till?
Oh, he lived to be in his 90s. He lived until 1948.
He must have been well nursed. Okay,
yes, he was.
No, we can't. We haven't got time. We've got to get...
One thing. Ever after, when the Truth magazine... newspapers,
yes.
Newspaper.
Terrible.
Melba was an alcoholic. Mother was always...
Of course she was. How could she have had that career as an alcoholic? Yes, she had vicious campaigns from Truth. John Norton in Truth was terrible to her, absolutely frightful. At one stage she said she was never coming back to Australia, and I think for a while she meant it, though she did come back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right down the back? Yeah. Okay.
Now, I counted an article by someone who was very supportive of Melba's husband, as though he'd been... in some sense slighted or not have a fair go.
Yeah.
I can't remember whether the problem was Melba herself or her binders or just gossips and commentators.
Gossips, probably. Yes, yes. Yes, thank you. Rafe, isn't it? Thank you for your question. Yes, well, he had a lot of virtues. They were totally ill-suited. He was almost tone-deaf, and, I mean, how could you be married to Melba and be like that? She really was somewhat unbalanced emotionally, I think, when the marriage took place, and she regretted it very, very quickly. They both did. And Melba had money, and the Married Women's Property Act had been passed, and she wasn't giving her money to Charlie. And he was an old-fashioned man who thought a wife's money should be his, and there were numerous arguments. They at times even came to physical blows over this. And if he hit her, she hit him back. She gave as good as she got. There was no shrinking violet or maidenly creature about Melba. He did have one wonderful talent, and I must tell you this because it really is quite spectacular. He was the most wonderful horseman. And Buffalo Bill was having at Earl's Court in London was having his Buffalo Bill show, which was Queen Victoria went three times and thought Annie Oakley was marvellous, which is very surprising. But they called for at one segment in the show, they would call for a rough rider from the audience to volunteer to get on this horse whose name was Misery, which gives you some idea. But Charlie had gone along all equipped. He had a special saddle which he had under his arm, and when they called, he ran down the front with his saddle and said he was going to do it, and would they please put the saddle on the horse. And the cowboys all said, you can't put that on the horse, he'll go mad, he'll kill you if he gets a saddle he's not used to. And Charlie said, put it on. It had something called a crupper, which apparently is a strap that goes actually around under the tail and really anchors the saddle on. So Charlie got up on this special saddle and he sat there like this, and they couldn't get him off. It caused a sensation. It was all written up in the Times, which is how I know, and it was so sensational that he was headhunted by a man who was training broncos that he brought over from America into polite horses for ladies to ride in England. So they needed a fair bit of braking, but it was said that 8 hours of Charlie on a bronco's back and it was as docile as a lamb.
Right down the back corner, yep.
Quick question. Was Nellie, in her own mind and in the world, known as the most famous Australian, or
yes,
she a citizen of the world?
Well, of course she would have regarded herself as a citizen of the world. She said, I put Australia on the map, and in many ways that was correct overseas. When she went to St. Petersburg to sing, there was a very funny article in a paper that said, we're absolutely amazed by this. We thought in Australia all the women wore grass skirts and beads and feathers, which shows, yes.
When was she in St. Petersburg?
1893, yes, quite early. Went with the Doreske brothers and caused a sensation. So, but certainly the most famous Australian, I think, that's ever been.
She toured enormously, and I've got this memory that we were on the west coast of Tasmania and she did some gigs there. Can you tell us a bit about her Australian tours?
Well, I can tell you about the West Coast. It was very, very unfortunate the first time she went to Launceston, because she got very sick on the little cockle shell of a boat going over, and she vomited so much that one of her vocal cords started to bleed. She sent for it. I mean, she was terrified of getting anything wrong, and she'd already had quite serious trouble with getting a nodule on her vocal cord some years before, and had great trouble getting it treated. So she was very worried about this, and she sent out a bulletin to the newspaper that she couldn't perform. And the Launceston people got furious, particularly as all sorts of people were coming from various parts of Tasmania. Special trains were being laid on from Hobart, and the governor was going, and they all had to be turned back, and it was a terrible sort of fiasco. And that was really what got John Norton onto her, because he wrote an article in Truth saying that she was drunk, and that's why she hadn't performed, which was absolute rubbish. However, she managed to pull back her reputation. The next time she came over, she went back to Launceston and gave a very successful concert. So all was forgiven.
Did she go down to the West Coast to the mining?
No, she didn't. I don't think ever.
Must have made it up.
I don't think so. Must have been another singer. Though she went to Kalgoorlie and Charters Towers and places like that, but not to miners in the West Coast of Tasmania. Anybody else?
Well,
we're going to have
here's a question.
One more.
There was some talk about her being somewhat bawdy. Is that correct?
Well, I guess I can.
The question is, for those at the back.
Bawdy. Was she bawdy? Well, she loved bawdy stories. And, of course, she mixed in Bohemian society where bawdy stories were really quite the thing, and she was very good at telling them. Usually she could tailor her manner and what she said to whatever sort of company she was with, but occasionally she slipped up. And there's a story about her being on board ship. It was a time when she was very anxious about her son's first marriage, so she was very on edge. And she was travelling with Percy Grainger's father. Now, Percy Grainger's father was a real old soak. He loved barmaids, and in fact he had venereal disease, as she found out later, not for personal things, but because he was a builder, and he built an extension to Coombe Cottage, and it's got terrible cracks in it, because he really didn't by that stage know what he was doing. Anyway, to return to the ship, they were at dinner one night, probably at the captain's table, I would suspect. Melbourne would never have sat anywhere else. And they brought round a jelly. And she looked at it and she said, "Not stiff enough. Jelly is one of the things I like stiff." And there was a terrible sort of silence. A terrible silence. She knew that Percy Grainger's father would appreciate it, but goodness knows what the other people thought.
Most of them didn't understand.
I think she hoped the ladies didn't understand it, yes.
Just in conclusion, before we go to our spontaneous encore, what was the problem? I mean, because Norton was an important figure in his time, and Melville, as you point out, was the best-known Australian of her time, perhaps of all time, but what was Norton's problem? Did they know one another? I mean, why these allegations? I mean, Melville obviously drank alcohol, did she? But she was...
Very much in moderation.
But she couldn't have been an alcoholic, she couldn't have performed. So what was Norton's problem, and was this ever addressed? Or?
Well, Norton's problem was he hated authority figures. I mean, Melville was not the only person. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the King, the Governor-General, I mean, you name an authority figure, but he'd had a go at them. And, of course, he had a following. A lot of people thought this was highly entertaining. To be hitting at the big poppies, and Melville was just one of the big poppies that he was having a go at. I mean, he was on about her morals, about her drinking, anything he could think of throwing at her, he threw. She thought of suing him, but then she thought if he got her in the witness box, God knows what would come out, because she had a lot of lovers. I must admit that was true, and anything might have... She was very discreet about all this, never talked about the Duke to anybody. So she decided that silence was the best thing, but she was certainly very unnerved. There were a number of episodes after the first attack by Norton that showed that she was very unnerved. But I think, you know, this alcoholic business, while he was writing these things, he was getting ready to go into Dr. Somebody's hospital in Melbourne for inebriates to get dried out. He was a terrible alcoholic himself. It was the feeling. That was why I think he was probably doing it, trying to shift his own sins onto somebody else, somebody innocent in this case.
Many thanks. So, look, I think we'll have our spontaneous encore now. So,
come on, Renee.
And then we'll conclude. There are copies of the book outside. So, Renee and Gavin. You're not. Okay.
Melba's very first song in public was Coming Through the Rye. She learnt it from her Scottish grandmother, and she was supposed to have had a very good Scottish accent. Renee's going to... You're not Scottish. Well, Martin's Scottish.
Yeah, my mum's people are Scottish, but yes. My accent is terrible.
And your father's side was?
English.
English. Your mother's side, Scottish. Okay. Right.
Okay. Gin a body, meet a body, coming through the rye. Gin a body, kiss a body, meet a body, cry. If a lassie has her laddie, they say hey hi. Yes, all the lads, they smile at me when coming through the rye. Gin a body, meet a body, coming through it, pray the town. Gin a body, kiss a body, need a body, frown. If a lassie has her laddie, may they say aye. Yet all the lads, they smile at me when coming through the rye.
Many thanks to Renee Martin and Gavin Lockley for a wonderful performance tonight, and we've already asked them back. Anne and I have got to negotiate this, but they're going to come back. And this time we had to lend out our Steinway Grand this evening, but we'll get it back for the next performance. We'll be better equipped. And to Anne Blaney, thanks for a wonderful speech. I mean, you've given us a real understanding. Thank you. given us a real understanding of Nellie Melba. I mean, I've learned a lot. I think we've all learned a lot, and you've done it with great charm and humour. So it's been a wonderful night, and I won't go on any longer. So just say to all of you, many thanks and well done. So, thank
you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.